It is important to note that there are more guns in this country than there are people. There are about 400 million firearms in civilian hands, and we really don't have a good handle about how many exactly, because there is no census or registry of this. About half of white Americans believe that guns are needed for the protection against tyranny. The only thing that I can tell you is that race, rights, and rifles will remain ideologically and politically entangled in American political life for a long time to come.
That's Alexandra Philindra, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Alexandra Philindra on race, rights, and rifles. Guns, guns, guns. In the United States, gun violence, shootings from schools to supermarkets to malls, is widespread and has become almost routine. The country is flooded with weapons. Americans may be the most heavily armed people on earth. Fascination with guns has its roots in the American Revolution, when notions of patriotism fused with a belief in white male supremacy and maintaining racial and gender hierarchies. It's patriotic to possess a gun. The corpses keep piling up, and the rulers do little to ameliorate the situation beyond mouthing platitudes such as, "Our thoughts and prayers go out to the victims." It's astonishing that a country with so many gun-related deaths does not enact meaningful regulation. Our guest today is Alexandra Philindra. She's professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's the author of Race, Rights, and Rifles: The Origins of the NRA and Contemporary Gun Culture. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in late April 2024. And now, Alexandra Philindra.
So to start, militarism is everywhere we look in today's politics. The valorization of firearms as an expression of cultural citizenship is not just a fringe phenomenon. Militarism is concentrated among white men who are far more likely not only to own guns, but to view guns in political terms. Furthermore, guns and allusions to armed violence as virtuous expressions of patriotism have become prominent themes in political campaign ads and the political discourse more broadly. Eric Greitens, who was a candidate for Senate in Missouri, is hunting rhinos. DeSantis, governor of Florida, plans to slice throats on day one. Trump tells us that the Proud Boys should stand by, and Joe Manchin, who's a Democratic senator out in West Virginia, shoots through Obamacare and various other bills over time. The phenomenon exists in both parties, but is definitely very asymmetrical. As gun culture participants love to say, guns in America are not about hunting ducks. They're about what it means to be a true American, what scholars call the content of American identity. Guns symbolize who Americans are, or should be, as citizens, and their relationship to state authority, and the role that they are expected to play in politics. Gun culture participants envision a very dark world where humans are egotistical, corruptible, and power mad. Given human frailty, entrusting political power in the hands of a small elite is very dangerous for democracy. When a political class controls lethal force, it may be tempted to dominate citizens and rule by force. Since political power flows not from electoral institutions, but from the barrel of a gun, firearms are a necessary means for citizens to maintain their sovereignty, and thus gun ownership is a fundamental right and duty of democratic politics. In fact, the right to bear arms is the country's first freedom, an absolute right and the only right that allows other rights to exist at all. The U.S. Supreme Court has recognized and legitimized gun ownership for self-defense and revolution against tyranny as a fundamental political right of American citizenship and has allowed for gun carry outside the home, thus legally enabling the performance of armed good citizenship in the public domain. Not any individual is capable of political virtue, according to this narrative. Virtue is linked to participation in a very specific culture, a common identity rooted in whiteness, heterosexual masculinity, and Christianity. Inclusive ideologies such as multiculturalism erode this common identity and make people weak and indifferent to institutions. They no longer develop vigilance and armed preparedness, allowing for corruption to enter the polity and endanger democracy. These quotes are from Charlton Heston, who was a president of the NRA in the late 90s. However, he's not alone. Senator Josh Hawley, eminent scholar too from Missouri, has laid out in his book a muscular warrior Republican vision of America situated in masculinity and a Eurocentric Christian national identity. What makes a republic, according to Hawley, is men. To share in self-government, he tells us, you have to stand strong against those who would try to make you dependent on their wealth or influence. To preserve liberty, you have to discipline your passions and sacrifice in the service of others. Americans are the righteous heirs of the Roman plebeians, who lived by his own labor and who voted without reward according to his own convictions. The plebeians drew on their masculine virtues of courage and independence and assertiveness to defend the republic. These are the qualities that the founding fathers recognized as indispensable for political liberty. Yet, the republic is in great threat, Hawley warns, because we have lost our ideological moorings. Political elites have forged a corrupt cosmopolitan consensus centered on multiculturalism, cutting off the people from history, shared beliefs, borders, and belonging, defending our common identity and the way of life that we share together, all of which are constitutive elements of the American nation. The decline in American masculinity will lead in future generations' inability to defend liberty and share in the work of self-government. And it's not just the NRA and gun culture that embraces militarism. It is quite prevalent indeed among white Americans overall. These are three surveys that I run in 2015, 2021, and 2023 that included two items related to militarism. The first item asked if gun ownership is a sign of good citizenship. The second statement said the government is so powerful that people need guns to protect themselves from government. In 2015, 43% of white Americans agreed that gun ownership is a sign of good citizenship. This declined a little bit in 2021 because this survey was like 3 months after January 6th, but then it rebounded to 33% by 2023. Even more scarily, in 2015, about half of white Americans believed that guns are needed for the protection against tyranny. And this also dropped a bit in 2021, but rose to 56% in 2023. It is important to note that there are more guns in this country than there are people. There are about 400 million firearms in civilian hands, and we really don't have a good handle about how many exactly because there is no census or registry of this. And gun ownership rates are declining. The gun stock is increasing. So what we're having is greater concentration of arms in fewer hands. On average, a gun-owning household may have about 8 firearms. The gun-owning population is far whiter and more male than the general population. So a group whose share of the population is shrinking progressively over time is accumulating, is maintaining its share within the gun-owning population and is accumulating a very huge number of firearms. The institutionalization of militarism by the Supreme Court and its warm embrace by substantial sections of the elites and the public alike represent a huge challenge to American democracy. At the same time, these Marshall ideas sit uncomfortably with key theoretical traditions to American democracy and identity. Militarism is antithetical to the Weberian premise that for democracy to flourish, the state must have a monopoly over the legitimate exercise of lethal force. The gun culture, its elite supporters, and to a degree the U.S. Supreme Court, reject these presumptions, asserting that legitimate armed force should be shared between the people and the state. Equally important, the gun culture's understanding of American identity that marries gun ownership, individual responsibility, and civic duty is a strange fit for both the creedal understanding of Americanism that is rooted in liberal individualism, a tradition central to gun studies, and the civic culture tradition that focuses on peaceful civic engagement, social capital, and as a precondition for nurturing trust in institutions. Liberalism has no place or space for civic obligations, let alone armed citizenship, while the civic culture prizes peaceful civic engagement as a precondition for building trust. So where does this militarism come from, and why is it so influential? I argue that militarism is a constitutive part of a system of ideas that links American cultural citizenship with white male supremacy. Specifically, I claim that the gun culture's understanding of who is a good American is founded in a potent mix of two ideological streams that have been central to American political development since the country's founding. Marshall republicanism, which is the belief that political virtue is nurtured through engagement with arms and one's willingness to defend the country to death, and what Roger Smith calls ascriptive hierarchies. Marshall republicanism explained what behaviors a citizen must exhibit to be entrusted with the public good. Ascriptive ideologies provided the narratives that justified the expectation that only some people, some categories of people, but not others, could develop political virtue and thus could be included as equals in the republic. There are two pairs of concepts central to republican ideology: virtue and corruption, freedom and slavery. In this early American context, corruption didn't just mean what we think about today, which is bags of money in freezers and quid pro quo exchange of money. Indeed, corruption had a very different meaning. In revolutionary era, Americans feared that a corrupt political leader will want to be a king, and this could be done if he could create a professional army paid for by the government and which would owe loyalty only to that leader. If the citizens didn't have access to firearms and weren't trained in their use, not only would they be unable to stop the collapse of the republic, but they would not have developed the political virtue to understand that it's even happening. They wouldn't be aware that the republic is falling apart. The founders told the story of the American Revolution as a tale of political virtue winning over corruption. In revolutionary pamphlets, the parliament was portrayed as a corrupt elite intent on destroying the colony's self-government. In one sense, this narrative is not very different from contemporary stories about the corrupt deep state and the Washington swamp. Virtue and corruption are connected to political freedom and slavery. What caused a change from freedom to slavery for Locke and other liberal thinkers was government action. The government, through its own decisions, enslaved people. What caused the change from freedom to slavery in the Republican tradition was the actions of an individual, a citizen who was not vigilant and did not prepare to protect freedom could lose it. Also, a person could willingly choose dependency or slavery in exchange for comfort and luxury. So freedom and slavery were individual choices. In this sense, citizenship was not a status conferred by civil authority, but a perpetual practice, a performance that necessitated constant reinforcement. Veering away from practicing citizenship could lead to slavery, and the citizen would be complicit in his change of political status. Today, this comes through in the NRA's and the Republican Party's warnings for constant vigilance to avoid the slippery slope of gun control, confiscation, and tyranny. If contemporary gun owners are slacking in fulfilling their duties as citizens, they don't vote and they don't contact their political leaders on behalf of gun rights, they may lose their freedom and only have themselves to blame. In the classical tradition, freedom and slavery are not racialized. Slavery is a political concept not associated with race and white supremacy. It is gendered since only men could be citizen soldiers, but it's not racialized. But in the US, the institution of chattel slavery became central to the American Republican definitions of freedom and slavery, and thus who deserved political membership. In this view, Black people had chosen the dependency and comfort of slavery over the independence and hardship of freedom. White Americans had earned their freedom and citizenship in the Republic because they recognized and fought against the corruption of the British Crown. They were thus virtuous and entrusted both with the vote and with the responsibility to defend the nation at arms. This ideology was founded upon four historical myths: that slavery was benevolent, which was not; that Black people did not fight for their freedom, which they did all the way back to the slave trade; that Black people could not be trusted to defend the United States, even though they served in every single American war; and that Black people were suspect because they made alliances with the enemy, which they did in furtherance to their quest for freedom. It is important to note that this is an intersectional ideology. It excludes on the gender and race dimension at the same time, and this has implications for women and African Americans who sought political integration through the military route. It didn't work as a strategy of inclusion because they pushed against one dimension while leaving the other unaffected. American martial ideology, this combination of militarism and white male supremacy, did not stay in the 18th century. It follows us to the present day. This ideology was transmitted through four vectors: the education system, public memory, popular culture, and the country's military institutions and the NRA. These ideas that link white men with political virtue and arms can be found in school books throughout the 20th century. If you're a baby boomer who grew up in Virginia, you may remember studying history out of the Cavalier Commonwealth, the state's approved history book published by McGraw-Hill in 1963. They were encoded in public culture in Confederate monuments that the Daughters of the Confederacy erected across the South. And they were even in contemporary monuments. There is a mural today in Florida, erected in 2000, which depicts the Ku Klux Klan as a chivalrous group of men who protected law and order. These ideas can also be found in popular movies, Gone with the Wind. But most importantly, that transmission through public culture is of ascriptive republicanism's institutional embeddedness in American military institutions. So what is that all about? The Uniform Militia Act of 1792 was one of the first laws that passed by the newly minted American government. The act set out to put into force the Second Amendment. It required that all white men of military age should be enrolled in the state militia, which today we call the National Guard. So when I talk about the militia, I'm really talking about the National Guards, and that they should buy and maintain their military weapons and relevant accessories. At a time that neither the federal government nor the states had the fiscal capacity to provide for the expenditures necessary for the common defense, the law essentially privatized the cost to individual citizens. State laws and constitutions closed the loop of martial republicanism. Not only did they require military service of all white men, but they also required enrollment in the militia as a precondition for voting in elections. Hence, they took seriously the citizen-soldier link. Today, the vision that we have of the militia, in part propagated by popular narratives such as that of the NRA, is that of the heroic Minutemen, who were expert shooters and committed citizen soldiers, the plebeians, the Roman plebeians. It is in the tradition of the Roman Cincinnatus, we are told, that American citizen farmers dropped their till and picked up their musket when the country asked them to. The historical reality of the era is a bit different. First, white American men had no interest in serving in the military because that was productive time taken away from their farms and families. And military service didn't pay, and they could not maintain their families otherwise. As a result, they resisted to the bitter end and used the power of the vote to force legislatures to grant exemptions and buyouts. Second, they didn't show up for musters and training. The trainings were very infrequent. Indiana logged like one training every several years, and especially in peace times, and legislatures were very uncomfortable about spending money to chase after these men and punishing men who were also voters. So citizen soldiers were undisciplined and untrained. Third, they insisted on voting in their own leaders for their units, and these decisions were based on social rank and not skill and experience, which added to the problems of discipline within the units. They also refused to serve outside of their towns and states and often defected to go back to their homes and families. Finally, militiamen were often drunk at musters and in battle. They were more concerned about the ornate uniforms than about military discipline. As a result, the Continental Army leaders and every federal commander through the 19th century had a very negative view of the militia. George Washington, Alexander Hamilton did not have good words to say. The militia were known as the Tin Men and Scarecrow Militia, and people generally really, really were upset about them. So if the militia were so terrible, why did they remain unreformed for over a century? Why did it take from 1792 until 1903 to reorganize and professionalize them? The answer lies in the citizen component of the citizen-soldier dyad. The militia were the voters. They had political power. From their ranks emerged local politicians. Militia musters were premier political events for parties and politicians to generate support and enthusiasm. And militia were military enforcement units for the parties. Edmund Morgan has called the militia schools of subordination, meant to reconcile the incongruity of popular sovereignty with a hierarchical society. They created a sense of political equality and solidarity among white men and enhanced the social distance between white men and everybody else. The political power of the militia did not end in the 19th century. According to Martha Dirsick, the National Guard Association was the country's most powerful lobbying group well into the 1960s. Here it is important to note that in the US was also home to African-American militia units. These units actually highlight the irony and paradox of ascriptive republicanism. Free black people in the North started organizing militia units without state approval in the 1830s as the sectional conflict deepened and people sensed the approach of the Civil War. These units survived until 1904, when they were dismantled as a result of the federalization of the National Guards. For abolitionists such as Frederick Douglass, black militia represented the promise of full political membership. He described how excited and nervous he was when he went to New Bedford, Massachusetts, to inspect the local black militia mustering on the 4th of July. Because for Douglass and other black leaders, black men's willingness to take up arms for the Union meant that their manhood, which was another word for citizenship at the time, their virtue, would surely be recognized by white society and that they could not be refused political rights. Ironically, this is the very reason why the Confederacy resisted enlisting enslaved people in the ranks, even as the defeat was nearing. Jefferson Davis and his government understood that their ascriptive Republican myth rested on slaves being incapable of military service, valor, and sacrifice. The tragedy is that when after pressure from the thousands of black men who served in the Union Army, the federal government created two black regiments, these soldiers were sent to kill Indians in the plains. Because African Americans were thought to be immune to tropical diseases, black National Guard units were sent to fight for American imperialism in Cuba and the Philippines. Incorporation into the martial half of citizenship meant defending white supremacy for African Americans. The same faith in military service as a path to political membership is what drove W.E.B. Du Bois 50 years later to urge his fellow African Americans to close ranks in 1918 as America entered World War I. "This is the crisis of the world," Du Bois wrote. "For all the long years to come, men will point to the year 1918 as the great day of decisions, the day when the world decided whether it would submit to military despotism and an endless armed peace, if peace it could be called, or whether they would put down the menace of German militarism. We of the colored race have no ordinary interest in this outcome. That which the German power represents today spells death to the aspirations of Negroes and all darker races for equality, freedom, and democracy. Let us not hesitate. Let us, while this war lasts, forget our special grievances and close our ranks shoulder to shoulder with our white fellow citizens. We make no ordinary sacrifice, but we make it gladly and willingly with our eyes lifted to the hills." But that is not how ascriptive Republican ideology works. Whites did not use the same criteria for whites and blacks, or for women for that matter. When black soldiers returned from the front, they were met not with political membership, but with a wave of lynchings and race riots that historians have called the Red Summer of 1919. The NRA was a product of the militia system. It was an organization formed by the National Guardsmen after the Civil War to actually train the guards in shooting and instill martial patriotism in white men of draft age. The same officers who formed the NRA also formed the National Guard Association, a group that has been considered among the most powerful lobbying groups in American history. Much of the NRA's power came from the fact that it represented the nation's citizen soldiers, who were not only voters, but also prominent citizens and local political officials. Furthermore, unlike the US Army, which was barred from lobbying Congress by the Pendleton Act, the National Guard was a state organization with constitutional origins and not subject to prohibitions. That made them incredibly powerful. And for almost a century, there was little light between the NRA, the National Guards, and the defense establishment in DC. Even as war was becoming mechanized, the NRA insisted that the most important part of the drill of a soldier is marksmanship on a scientific basis. And the importance of marksmanship was not military alone. It created good citizens. The disastrous mobilization of 1897 increased the urgency for competent soldiers in the eyes of their military leaders. The NRA and the NGA got lucky in the early 1900s. First, whatever their differences, the two parties did not differ in support of the National Guards. Democrats shared a commitment to the National Guard, despite their suspicion of the Federal Army. In the early years of the 20th century, the NRA had major allies in Washington. President McKinley, before his untimely death, his successor Teddy Roosevelt, were both National Guard officers, and so was Representative Dick of the Armed Services Committee and others. They all band together, and the NRA and the NGA filed similar plans for a civilian marksmanship program. The exact same ideas found their way to a War Department report written by none other than a National Guard officer. The plan was enacted as part of the Dick Act of 1903 and subsequent national defense laws. In addition to the federalization of the state militia, the Dick Act created a civilian marksmanship program and ordered the Army, which was not happy about this, to provide surplus firearms and ammunition for free or at cost only to NRA-affiliated gun clubs and individuals. So they established a monopoly for the NRA and its members. The government also funded NRA rifle competitions and provided soldiers for free labor. The NRA had a monopoly over civilian marksmanship training for a century, during which the draft was instituted three times. It also had monopolistic access to these discounts to arms and ammunition until 1968. Even today, the NRA is NRA certified trainers who train civilians in guns for permit purposes. And today, the NRA boasts about 5 million members, which we don't really know if that is true because we don't have access to their records.
You're listening to Alexandra Philindra on Race, Rights, and Rifles. This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So strong was the monopoly of the NRA that in 1967, in the midst of the Detroit riots, the local police had to pay NRA memberships for its members in order to get access to the surplus federal guns and ammunition through the CMP. That's quite interesting. How could the government know whether criminals got access to its arms and ammunition, all these programs that were basically giving ammunition for free? So the expectation was that the NRA weeded out bad guys through its referral program. In the tradition of fraternal organizations of the late 19th and early part of the century, new members needed to get the support and referral of an existing member. These allowed the organization to remain a pretty closed club that effectively kept out people of color and immigrants, undesirable people. State laws, and specifically the Uniform Firearms Act of 1926, followed suit. The NRA card was all that was needed to assure police that guns were legally owned. So you showed your NRA card, and the police would let you go if they found guns in your car. This is the origin, in a sense, of the good guy with a gun, a card-carrying member of the National Rifle Association. An NRA membership card, that is membership to a private organization, constituted evidence of good citizenship to the degree that this person could be entrusted with a government-provided firearm, and they could be exempted from gun control legislation, such as state or local licensing and registration. The NRA narratives, and maybe more so the pictures in its magazines, tell the story of who these virtuous citizen soldiers and the good guys with the gun are. Most provocative is this cartoon from 1944 in which a black soldier, speaking in slang, tells his officer that assembling an M1 is a mystery to him. The NRA publications do the work of race mostly through implicit messaging, especially pictures. This is a very interesting ad from 1968 for Savage rifle. And the association is pretty clear on what its vision of the virtuous gun owner looks like. Respectable, employed, white men, with a couple of well-groomed women thrown in the mix. There are 25 people in this picture. Three are women. Every one of them is white. Up until 2008, there are very few pictures of non-whites featured in The American Rifleman. And we know because I had four graduate students go through every issue and count every picture and code them. So I can tell you exactly how many there were. From January 1960 to January 2008, I located a dozen such pictures. The first is a picture of the great white hunter on a safari. The second, related to race protests and the mayhem of the late 1960s, which is viewed very disapprovingly by the riflemen, and it has a very interesting article in 1970 that is called Of Black Panthers and Blind Kittens. The third is a recurring ad for the Savage Rifle that has the Indian chief there. The fourth is from the dedication of the Buffalo Soldiers Memorial in 1992. And anyone who reads the article and didn't know what the Buffalo Soldiers were, they would still have no clue. Then from 2008, the issues is filled with pictures of angry Obama and angry Eric Holder. There are lots and lots of them. Over the past 2 years, there seems to be a change in the association strategy. We've seen a lot of targeting of African American women. I do not see any efforts to present black men in the magazine. And what is interesting is how these women are portrayed. They're very, very pink, very, very smiley, and very non-threatening. They exist only in the social plane. They're very interesting. They're crime victims, but they're never soldiers or citizens. Another theme that's popular is anti-Semitism. Themes and conspiracies often related to anti-Semitism, George Soros, even though he has not been involved with gun culture and gun laws, is very, very frequently portrayed in the NRA stories. And it's very problematic how the group treats the Holocaust, because basically the story there is that if Jews had guns, then the Holocaust would have been avoided. And the same is true of the way they understand slavery. They have an interesting way of talking about women, too. Unlike white men, who for the most part in the history of the magazine have been depicted as citizens and soldiers, and secondarily as sportsmen and hunters, women do not exist as in the political realm. Women are rarely citizens and even less so soldiers, even though women have been officially admitted into the armed forces since 1948. From 1930 through today, only one woman soldier ever graced the cover of the magazine. The NRA typically portrays women as victims of potential victims of crime. As the weakest sex, they are in danger of being overpowered by physically stronger men who are implicitly always the danger. Their key responsibility is to protect their virtue and the life of their children. And in this context, the gun becomes a great equalizer. Interestingly, even though the issue of domestic violence has become central to the gun control debate, in the NRA, it's always about stranger danger. It's never the husband or the partner who is the danger to the woman. And they have actually doubled down on this idea, and they're calling it feminism, like gun feminism. And they are basically accusing the left of hypocrisy, that basically guns is what provides women with power, and the left, by wanting to take away guns, are actually disempowering women, and it's not their political rights, but guns that provide power to women. Today, the NRA is in decline because of internal scandals. However, even if the NRA disappears tomorrow, its worldview has been inscribed in America's law thanks to the U.S. Supreme Court decisions in Heller, McDonald, and Bruin. This new institutional environment opens up a whole bunch of new questions, both theoretical and practical. First, as political scientists, we need to grapple with the contradiction between the new American state and the Weberian presumption of the monopoly of legal force. What does it mean for state capacity to share legitimate use of force between the people and the state? I hope my presentation answered to you the mystery of who aspires to be Scalia's able-bodied men of the nation, but the court still leaves a lot of questions unanswered. One pressing one has to do with the public performance of armed citizenship. Are we entering a future where people will retreat from public spaces such as parks and farmer markets because government can no longer keep guns out of there? Are people going to be scared to participate in political protests because the Proud Boys are standing by? Will we be scared to drop off a ballot because some citizen soldiers are defending the spot with AR-15s and beer coolers? Are we on the road to completely transforming political representation because elected officials refuse to run as a result of threats and violence, and those who run completely change their home style, steering away from in-person meetings and town halls and restricting access? I don't have answers to these questions. The only thing that I can tell you is that race, rights, and rifles will remain ideologically and politically entangled in American political life for a long time to come. Thank you. The question was, what is the relationship between various hunting and sports shooting organizations and the NRA? So the NRA has an arm that represents those groups as well. So it coordinates other groups that especially focus on hunting and sports shooting, but also does its other political, more directly political work. So all of these organizations are related, and there is some competition, not so much with the sports organizations, but with the more extreme political organization, like the Gun Owners of America are on the right of the NRA and have become far more pushy on certain things. So the NRA has lost some membership to them, apparently. They're more scared of them. But basically, the NRA has for many years been the coordinator of everybody who's involved with firearms in different capacities. So the question is, how does the urban-rural divide, which is very prominent in gun culture, how does that fit with this story? Urban and rural are code words for race and for nativity. So we have known, and we have a lot of evidence from experimental studies and from a variety of work across the board, that the term urban means black people, and the term rural means white Christian virtuous people, for the most part. And it's actually very interesting that the one time that the NRA's periodicals actually feature an African-American gun activist on the cover. His name is Colion Noir, and he is a lawyer, and he lives in a city. I think he's from Chicago. And they actually call him an urban a gun activist. And I'm like, that is very curious, because I had my students search the entire magazine again to see if anybody else is being called urban, associated with urban, and they're not. So I think it relates to the race and also the immigrant dimension. They're code words for that. So the comment was that the presentation was unfair and unbalanced to the NRA, and not productive in terms of contemporary problems, and also that the NRA took a turn for the worse in the 80s because of Wayne LaPierre. The NRA, I did not mention, the history, the contemporary history of the NRA is well covered by a lot of scholars and journalists. It's true, in 1977, there was an internal coup, the Cincinnati coup in the NRA, where the hardliners, who believed that there should be no compromise on guns, took over the association. And from there, they developed a very strong argument about the Second Amendment, the Second Amendment as an individual right, and not only as an individual right of defense, but as a political right against tyranny. And my book is basically about that and the origins of that aspect of American political culture, that it's not just the contemporary NRA, but these ideas have a very long trajectory, long lineage. I'm a member of the NRA as well, so is my husband. It's actually an organization that has a very interesting history as a basically part, very important part of the Department of Defense. They did a lot of work to prepare the Army, but their work was also imbued with the ideologies of the time, and they worked within the context, the historical context, that was true of the time. So they also, though, brought this ideology along with them after the changes of the 1960s. The defense establishment changed, but the NRA's ideology didn't change very much, and that's obvious from its magazines. So I am sorry that you feel that the presentation was unbalanced. Has there been any change to the NRA since the ousting of Wayne LaPierre? I don't know. It's too early to tell. Definitely what I see from their magazines is that they are trying to appeal to new constituencies, but the way that they seem to appeal to them is with a specific lens that is, you know, their traditional lens. So I don't see them ideologically as changing, because I can tell you that, and probably I'm speaking for some of the women in here, that what attracts me to products is not them being pink, even though I love pink. You just are not going to sell me on a gun by showing me, a young woman in pink shorts with a big pink AR-15 is not an ad that's made for me. So clearly, they are not really listening. They're focused on their main constituency, which is white men, and older white men at that. And they're also trying to sort of bring in these other constituencies, but not really go to them where they are. And a key issue, for example, is like they do not talk about domestic violence. Like, you're talking about, you know, women needing guns for protection, and the word domestic violence is absent from the magazines ever. And again, we looked, we counted. That is a problem because, you know, they're limiting themselves. They're sort of staying away from the social issues that actually relate to real women's lives. I see them doing marketing campaigns, but I don't think that they're actually truly engaging with the social problems that undergird gun violence. Their only solution to gun violence is more guns. And the slogan is more guns, less crime. That's all they have to offer. Every time that there is an uptick in crime, or every time that there is a school shooting, it's like, put more guns in there. There's no discussion about other things. So, 1967, the Black Panthers walked into the Sacramento State House in California with big guns on them, open carry, because at the time that was allowed. And within days, California passed gun control, and then the federal government also passed gun control by 1968. And the NRA supposedly, and it's only supposedly, supported these efforts. In reality, the NRA was trying to thread the needle in a way. They knew it was happening, so they wanted to basically be part of the process in order to make sure that they would get the most watered-down version of the legislation. So it looked like they were supporting it, and that's what's been reported, but really it was, if they realize they're a very smart organization, if you stay out of the process and just say, I reject this, you have no say on the product. So they participated in the process, and they watered down the Gun Control Act of 1968. And definitely they were very much against the Black Panthers. They stated in their editorials, they call them, and I never understood the title. It's called Black Panthers and Blind Kittens, and they say the Black Panthers are racist, and we are not. We are ecumenical. We accept everybody. They're racist. They definitely use implicit racial cues to say urban crime, and you know, you need guns for urban crime, and all of that. At the same time, right now, they are in a crossroads because older white men are literally dying. So, you know, the population is shrinking, and it is their key demographic is older white men, and actually middle and upper middle class white men who can buy products that are pretty expensive. Guns are not cheap for the most part, and especially if you add all the various attachments to it, like it is a consumer culture, and it's when you start buying these things, you buy all kinds of other things that relate to it. So they need to expand the market because their market is shrinking. So they're trying to have these forays into women mostly, white women, but also now African-American women, that they're not going into black men because I think that their core demographic who reads the magazine may not feel very comfortable seeing these young black men with guns in the pictures. It's a very difficult path to navigate. And the way they do it is sort of with a white male audience, I think, in their minds, because at my class at UIC, UIC is very diverse, the University of Illinois Chicago where I teach is very diverse, and I have 22 students in my class, of which only one is white. So I showed them that picture, and I asked, you know, what do you think? One Latina woman raised her hand, and she said, Professor, I think this is a white man's vision of what a black woman should look like. It's not how I see myself or my group or we see our group. So there's this tension there in the presentation, which is very interesting. Again, it's sort of, they're grappling to sort of get this new audience but not deal with the base problems that these other groups really care about. So to try to fit them into this mold, and it doesn't quite work. The Gun Owners Association, which is a newer group, and the Shooting Sports Foundation organization, Second Amendment organizations, there are a variety of those. There are also state-level ones. I know that in their origins, which were in the 1980s, the Gun Owners Association or so, was far more radical than the NRA, far more absolutist, and the NRA had a hard time sort of navigating that line between making some concessions, especially in the early 90s, and not losing membership to Gun Owners for America, who were very, very hardliners, but I don't know what they look like today. I know that they're gaining membership for sure, and there are like a ton of them. There are many, many organizations now across the country.
You were just listening to Alexandra Falindra on race, rights, and rifles. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in late April 2024. Alexandra Falindra is professor of political science at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She's the author of Race, Rights, and Rifles, The Origins of the NRA and Contemporary Gun Culture. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Ilan Pape, Medea Benjamin, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, and Naomi Klein. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To get copies of today's program, Alexandra Philindra on Race, Rights, and Rifles, and for her book, Race, Rights, and Rifles, The Origins of the NRA and Contemporary Gun Culture, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Matt Laubach recorded the program. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with the great tenor saxophonist Sonny Rollins performing Freedom Suite. Mm-hmm.